The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. On this festival day for River Master Jiyu, I thought what I would do is talk about some of my memories of River Master Jiyu and some of the teachings that she left us with. Okay. So I first met River Master Jiyu at the University of Santa Clara. It was 1970 or 1971, I'm not sure. But it was she had come to speak in a world religions class that I was taking at the university. Obviously, she had come to talk about Buddhism. I couldn't then, after she spoke or now, remember much of what she said. I think I remembered her analogy of karma and the light bulb. The light bulb goes out and you put in another light bulb. What it really was about her is that I remember how she was. Okay? And that's what remains with me to this day. Okay? She wasn't arrogant, although it was obvious that she knew what she was talking about. And, this was early 70s in the Bay Area. It was wild. She was kind and patient in her speech. I just remember how somebody would ask a question, she would give an answer, and they obviously weren't understanding, and she would just try again. The way she was really impressed me. And I grew up not far from the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco and lived there in the 60s. 50s, 60s, early 70s. And there were a lot of good things that happened in the countercultural movement, the hippie days, and there was a certain arrogance that I think some of us had. I include myself in that. There was this thing about people having some kind of experience and then becoming instant authorities on all kinds of things, and it didn't quite register. Also, there was this thing that would happen. Sometimes you go to these various talks or meetings, and the person who was speaking would get really glassy-eyed and strange. It's just something funny quality about it. Well, this isn't something that River Master Jiyu exhibited. Okay. As I say, it was just this kindness and straightforwardness and non-arrogance. And there's also a certainty there, but it was soft. Okay. And I knew that, after finding out a bit about her, that this person had spent 7 years in Japan and that she was a Zen master. And yet she didn't have the pretense of I know it all. So I was in this class, this world religions class, which was one of the many speakers that came to speak at the class during that quarter. We were on the quarter system. And then she came back the next year, or next quarter, something. Again, my exact association with time is a bit blurry. But she came back, and the teacher of this class, who was a Jesuit, knew that I found her quite interesting and found world religion, Buddhism, very interesting. So he invited me back to the class again when she came again. And he also invited me to go to the faculty club with her and him and any of those who had come with her for lunch. I'd never been in the faculty club in my life. I had hair down beyond my shoulders. I had a beard. And I think, as I remember, I was wearing overalls. And, you know, here we've got two, there was one other monk with Reverend Master, so two bald-headed people in robes, this Jesuit and this kid. It just, I still have the picture in my mind. I don't remember anything about the lunch. I don't know what we had. I don't know what we talked about. I just don't remember anything. Okay, but when we had finished and we were leaving, she said to me, she said, please come visit us sometime. And it, you know how when someone, there's this contact that they make with you, you know, people say the Dalai Lama has that quality that when he talks to you, it's like he's, you're the only person in the world that he is talking to. Well, I felt like she was really talking to me, and this was a point in my life where there was, I was very confused, suffering intensely, and you know, so I came very soon after. I started coming to retreats, and what she said left this warm impression on me, and I came for retreats soon to the Abbey, and then started coming, and then very, not so long after, in the scope of time, became a monk. Okay. One memory. I had been a novice monk at the Abbey for about 6 months when my college loans came knocking. So it's a little different in those days than it was. You know, you have to have your loans paid off now. I still owed some money on my college loans, and I wasn't going to renege on them, but I had this kind of strange idea that they would give you a grace period. And of course, they didn't. There was no grace period. The person from the loan, whatever it was going to be up here if I didn't have the money, you know, for the next payment. So I went down to the Bay Area and lived at the Berkeley Priory for 6 or 7 months, and I worked in a bakery in San Leandro, which was a great experience. And I got some skills, you know, as a baker. I mean, this was a family bakery. You did everything pretty much from scratch. So I really learned techniques and how to handle things. It was one of these sink or swim situations because the stuff was just coming at you. It's not like the bakery stops because you need to learn things. You got to keep up with the bakery. And, you know, I learned to do things, I think, sort of quickly. And, you know, so when I came back to the monastery, I had this skill. And I think everybody was thinking he's got this skill. And I ended up in the kitchen as the baker. They were, I think, two head cooks at the time who alternated, and I was the baker. And, you know, I baked things, but you know how people love donuts? Well, people, I think maybe remember Master or somebody said, can you make donuts? And I had enough experience. I actually hadn't made donuts before, but I had a lot of experience with dough and mixing things, and I love donuts too. So I made donuts, and we had we would have a donut night. I think it might have been as frequently as once a week. Yeah. And I actually, you know, I could make jelly donuts and maple bars, and well, it's just the shape of things, and you know, and everybody liked their donuts. Well, Master Jiyu, so this was maybe in the spring of that year, my first year as a monk, and then again, I can't remember when these things exactly when these things happened. But Reverend Master went down to the Bay Area, the Berkeley Priory, for the summer, as she usually did, because it's just too hot for her here. And I think we continued the donut nights, and when she returned in the fall, donut night time rolled around, and I made donuts. And we had donuts, but something was funny. It's not like the donuts were bad or anything, but just something that didn't seem. It was like greed fest. At least, you know, when I started looking at it, and her master didn't look too happy. Well, she didn't say anything. She didn't say don't make donuts anymore, or we won't have any donut nights anymore. But I didn't make donuts anymore. I just kind of decided this isn't a good idea anymore. It's one of those things you occasionally have when you're in tune, and nobody ever said anything to me, so I guess, donuts just faded away sort of as a regular thing. And I never said anything to anybody else about it. I just didn't have donuts. Okay? So I went on to become the cook at the Abbey, actually for 20-something years, and pretty much solid time. I mean, I had construction skills. I was the head of the goats for a while, but pretty much the next 20 years I spent in the kitchen, or 20 years plus. And during that time, I received a lot of valuable instructions from River Master. It wasn't always easy. It didn't always come as I would like something to come. But it came, and actually, I'm very grateful for it. Some of that teaching was direct, and some of it I intuited, maybe like the donut thing. Well, I love jalapeno jack cheese. To this day, if you can have cheese, just skip everything else and let's have. Please don't give me lots of jalapeno jack cheese. So we hadn't had jalapeno cheese at the Abbey, and I thought, well, I'll get some, in our dairy order, and I'll make grilled cheese sandwiches for everybody for the medicine meal. Okay, I did that. That's all I made was jalapeno jack, because I thought everybody loved jalapeno jack, because wouldn't they? Because I do. Isn't that how we think some of the time? Okay. Well, everybody didn't love jalapeno jack. It was not so kind in some people's stomachs, because they probably didn't know it was there until they bit into it. So I had a call that night from River Master Jiyu's house asking me to come down there. Which I did, and she asked me not to make hot pepper sandwiches anymore. So I didn't. Okay. And this was one of my many lessons in cooking in the monastery. I'm sure this is very true for all of you, family, if you're couples, friends are over. You just can't cook what you like. You have to consider other people. It's a really important dimension. Even if you think, oh, this food is so healthy for people, you kind of got to look at, is it moving? Maybe it's really healthy, but it's not moving. People are not, So you learn from that, And I learned from her in that way about, looking at what I was doing and not taking the fact that people didn't want to eat something as that they're bad people. Or if it's being served over and over again because I made way too much, well, I got to learn something there. It's not a question about bad people, they're monks, they should eat. It's just, you made too much of this and it wasn't very tasty. So you have to cook for other people, and of course this is not just about cooking; it's about many things in our lives. We've got our idea of what we like, the way it should be, and of course it would be that way for other people, wouldn't it? Well, of course it's not, and you gotta wake up to that. Yeah, you have to have a mind that's bigger than opinions, especially your own opinions. Your own mind has to be bigger than your opinions. Reverend Master Jiyu herself had a lot of food intolerances. Her stomach was not in good shape. This was partly from living in the East, partly because of her time as a child during the war in England, where there wasn't very much food. She had a lot of food intolerances, and I honored those, okay? When I found out about them, then I tried to not do those things for her. She wasn't asking that we not do them for the whole community. And during this time when I was cook, a good portion of the time we had goats. We had a big herd of goats. And we had goat's milk, wonderful, fresh, unpasteurized goat's milk. Well, she couldn't eat goat's milk. She tried it, and it just didn't work. So when I would make things for the community, I'd often make something separately for her with cow's milk so that she could eat it. Now, why I didn't make it, I was realizing this morning, why I didn't just make everybody's thing with cow's milk, I don't know. I mean, it would have been a little extra expense, but it would have been far easier. But we tend to complicate things. So we're having, say, a Thanksgiving feast, and we're having this English thing, Yorkshire pudding. You know what popovers are? Yorkshire pudding is like a big popover, you know. And in the ideal, it's light and fluffy and rises. Okay, and there's also this thing about, you know, people say it's easier to do smaller amounts of cooking than it is big amounts. Things don't kind of, well, you know, my big ones would end up fine. You know, they look rising out of the pan and look, you know. And then I make this little one for her. It is like a brick. It didn't look light and fluffy. Okay. So sometimes I try to make another one. It's the same thing. Okay, same thing. You know, she never at the table said, "Why is mine like this?" Okay. As the years went on and Reverend Master's health declined, she wasn't able to come to everything in the monastic schedule. And she had really poor health. And you had to live around her to really know that. But she had really poor health. And you always had to be on your toes, because if you thought, "Oh no, Reverend Master won't be here, you know, I don't have to do this or that," you know, there she was. She had this way of being there all of a sudden. So one day, it's lunchtime, and we're having some kind of tempeh dish for lunch. We made our own tempeh for years here. It was really good. You know, the monks got really skilled at making it. Reverend Master never ate tempeh. He just never ate tempeh. Well, this one day, she comes up for lunch, and she asked me to serve her up some tempeh. And I thought, oh my God, she's going to die. You know, this is just not, you know, because I cared and she never ate it. And so my heart's kind of sinking. But I served it to her. I didn't say, "You want her, Master? You can't." I just served it to her. And, you know, she said that was good. She ate the meal, said it was good. She never ate tempeh again. Never ate it again. So there's a teaching that River Master Jiu gave, I think, to everyone, but I particularly remember it, and it goes way back. I mean, it's 40 years old or more for me. And it's about the importance of meditation practice. Okay, And it has rung true through all these years. It doesn't, you know, this teaching, there's something about it. It was very simple. Okay, she said that if you take time to meditate, there will be enough time. If you don't take time to meditate, there never will be enough time. You will spin. The mind, you know. And I mean, I really found that to be true for myself, okay? Over and over and over again. You know, time's an interesting thing to think about. We can't stop it. We can't control it. It ticks on. I was really noticing that at the Hermitage this time. You know, now here I'm there for a few days, then I'm there for 2 weeks, then I'm there for 3 weeks, and then it's getting towards the end. 24 hours. Yeah, you know, I wasn't like, "Oh my God," but you know, I just noticed this thing about time. As we get older, I've heard people say this, and I think it's true. It seems to move even faster. okay, than it did. Actually, in actual fact, it's not faster or slower. It's just the constant movement of impermanence and change. We're just much more aware of it. You know, our master used to say, when you're young, you think you're Superman and Superwoman. And then you get older and you realize you're not. You know, it's the way it is. It's not a problem that you do that when you're younger, but you do, because, you know, unless there's been some kind of illness in the family or you yourself have it, you may not. You just think you got all the time in the world. And as we get older, we realize we don't have all the time in the world. You know, if we're lucky, we'll have some more time. Okay. As we know, if we choose to cultivate a meditation practice, we need to take regular, consistent time to practice. Okay. Sporadic, I think it's better than not meditating, but for me, I'd say at least, It's the regular, consistent time of meditation that seems to help strengthen and deepen my meditation. Okay? And I don't know that I can even really tell you what strengthen and deepen means, but there's something that solidifies. It's like, you know, after years of doing it, that's where you go. That's where you go. Okay? And it's true of many habits. And of course, good habits in our life are better than not so good habits. In a monastery, meditation is built into the daily schedule. Or maybe a better way to put it is the monastic schedule is built around meditation. Okay. I really admire and respect people who live in the world who maintain a meditation practice. Because it's, you're not living in a, you know, it's a little harder. It's not like, you know, you get up in the morning and there's the posted schedule and the bells are going. You got to make yourself get in there and put the time in. and I say here too that Reverend Master Jiu was a really big proponent of 10 minutes of good meditation. She would say to people, okay, you can't do 40 minutes. Can you do 10 minutes? Can you do 5 minutes? Can you do that consistently? If you're a parent and you have young children, when you get up in the morning, can you sit on the side of your bed for 2 minutes? You know, again, this is time we're talking about here, and 2 minutes better than 40 minutes than 10 minutes? Not necessarily. Okay. Sometimes when people come and talk with me, having difficulties, they come and talk with me. I don't know, for some reason I ask them, are you keeping up your meditation practice? Okay. I keep kind of getting a regular meditation practice. And actually, you know, I can't give you the statistics on it, but often people say no. I kind of went by the side there. Fallen away. So my encouragement then is to get back on the horse. Start up a regular meditation practice again. Because I think, I know, and really all I can say is I know for myself, that meditation really helps clarify and remedy our suffering. Okay, so let's go back to talking about time in our lives. There's only a certain amount of time in a day. 24 hours. You know, we can't get 25 hours. So we can only do so many things. You know, I mean, time, things take time to do. We can only do so many things. We can only be in so many places. Okay. So there's this limiting quality about time. It limits us. You know, we're mere human beings, and we can think all these things need doing. It's really important. you know how we go on. But we simply cannot do everything. I think we also cannot be everybody. You know, be whatever you can be, whatever that slogan was. You can't be everything. You can't do everything. There's this built-in fact that we can't do everything right now. And that sometimes, I've seen with myself and other people, we get anxious. We get fearful. We get upset. We get frustrated. Even angry. Because we got to do all this stuff. How are we going to do it? Those people should be doing all that stuff. And we need to have all this done. Okay. Well, we can't do everything. I think if we pursue time in that way, with being anxious, fearful, upset, if we hold on to that, those emotions, those feelings, we really suffer. Okay? And it goes beyond ourselves. We can make it really uncomfortable for other people. Please don't misunderstand me. You have to get things done. To be a responsible human being, it's necessary to get things done. You know, to maintain a job, to have a good practice, good spiritual practice. You need to get things done. It isn't just, oh, well, whatever, you know. No, you need to get things done. But you can't do everything. And I've really found what River Master said to be true, that a regular meditation practice helps you to let go of those feelings. And in fact, you get done what needs to be done. You can put it down. Because you know how it is, we didn't get something done, we start worrying about it, we don't sleep. You know, it just snowballs, and it's really quite hard on our skandhas. Yes, it's interesting because this meditation and time, there's a bit of a paradox that gets going here, because we realize we bump into our limits. We realize we can't do everything. Meditation just doesn't set us free to do everything all the time. You know, we realize that there's choices throughout the day that we need to make. And, I don't know how, you know, some of us are list people. I don't know if I'm particularly a list people, but I found lists okay as long as they're not like an ultimatum. They're more like just a guide to help us organize ourselves, because organized is good. I think it's also good to hang loose in being organized, because if you don't hang loose a bit in being organized, you stifle the creative nature of a human being for yourself and others. You got to kind of hang loose within that. And we can, lists can turn into frustrated desire to complete things. Or they can be rough guides. So I think being a human being, there's always going to be much more to do than we can do. And of course, there's always going to be new things. That's the thing about lists. You got to allow for the new things. And sometimes things take precedent. And this is not a problem. It's really a sign of an engaged life. You know, that we're kind of step out into life and we're responsible. And yet we know we have to let go. You know, we can't control everything. And meditation for me is actually about an engaged life. So it's engaged in the present moment life. And not hopping all around the map. You know, just engaged in present moment life. And I think meditation brings balance and peace. We begin to see the correct ordering of our everyday life. We realize what is most important. In some ways, I think life has a triage quality to it, you know. We can't do everything, so we do what we can. And the real question might be, do we need to do everything, and what is good to do? And of course, meditation helps with this. Okay. And I'm talking here both about formal meditation. I think it's good. And I'm talking about meditating in your everyday life. Okay? Because it's just not sitting on the cushion and then floating out into everyday. You have to bring meditation into everyday life. And you actually have to bring it into the places where it's difficult or we get frustrated. You know, those are the opportunities to really bring in meditation. It's amazing to me what River Master Jiyu did. Although she was limited by time and health, you know, I'll never do that much. And, you know, she really left a magnificent legacy here for us. She used to say that you have to learn to meditate on the run. You know, that you need to bring stillness out into activity. She talks about that in Zen is Eternal Life. I think it's in the chapter about Samantabhadra. I'll reiterate this again. Meditation isn't just for sitting on a cushion. It's for every aspect of our everyday life. That's why I like it. You know, that's why I like our practice. It's about everyday life. When we feel anxious and frustrated, And there's a seeming mountain of activity and stuff to do, we can choose to meditate right there. Okay? And we can cut through at least the added thing that we put in there, which is the anxiety and the frustration, and maybe even worse. You know, and we just can see what needs doing. And you know, I think there's actually enough time to do what needs doing. We just have to loosen up on what we think it is that we need to do. And see it as it actually is, not as we'd like to manipulate it with the best intentions, but just see it as it truly is. And time can become our compassionate friend. It can point us to the full recognition of impermanence. They're really valuable for that. It's just ticking, ticking, ticking. You know, clocks are... That's why you have a clock in the meditation hall. It reminds you of the impermanence. It just keeps ticking. And actually, when you can see the full recognition of impermanence, you see that which is unconditional. I don't know if it's bound by time or not bound by time. I mean, I don't care. It's just unconditional. But the secret is, we have to choose to meditate unconditionally to find this place. Okay? It's right there. It doesn't need to find us. We need to make that choice. Thank you.